What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Hi, how's it going, Gabe?
Feeling great.
Feeling groovy. Great. Awesome. Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show, which you can hear every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. And I'm here with my main man, Gabriel Pacheco.
That's right. How's it going, Katie?
I'm good. I'm feeling great. So we are interviewing today a very special guest. He's a real lefty lawyer. His name is Ian Samuel. He is a professor at Indiana Law School. He was a Clemenco Fellow and lecturer on law at Harvard Law School and clerked for Justice Scalia, as Whoa. In Antonin Scalia. Yeah.
We're going to ask him about
We're
that,
totally
right?
Gonna, yeah, he has a lot to answer for. He was also a Bristow Fellow in the Office of the Solicitor General and an appellate litigator in the Justice Department's Civil Division. He has two cats and nearly as many opinions, which can be found on Twitter at ISAMUEL. He's also the host of First Mondays, which is a great podcast on the Supreme Court. So let us now turn to Ian Samuel. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh my God, it's such an honor. I've been trying to get an invite for a while, but you got to play these things cool. So I did it by saying nothing.
Yeah, we don't like our guests too eager. They have to be very nonchalant.
You got to have nonchalance.
Yeah, exactly. The nonchalance game, yeah. Well, it worked. So there's so much that we could talk about with you. Let's start with what's going on right now. Of course, the danger in that is that it'll become out of date in about a second because things are moving so quickly. But can you kind of set us up, tell us what's happening, explain to non-jurists the significance of this whole Brett Kavanaugh mishigas, if you will? I think that's the legal term for it.
Yeah, I think mishigas is a very important legal term.
It is.
He's going to have a mishigas about this for the rest of his life, I guarantee you that much.
Yeah,
so
he deserved it.
What's so amazing about this is, you know, when Justice Kennedy retired, it was obviously a really big deal because anybody who would be appointed to replace him was going to be a lot more conservative. I mean, Justice Kennedy was already incredibly conservative, and I am on record as not liking him as a jurist at all.
Mm-hmm. So we
it was a big deal.
We shouldn't miss him. Good riddance.
Yeah. Yeah, good riddance. Good riddance to Anthony Kennedy, I say.
Yeah.
But not because I'm excited about his replacement.
Right.
So Brett Kavanaugh gets nominated, and he's this dude really out of central casting, right? He would have been nominated by President Rubio or President Jeb or really anybody because he's just like the obvious guy, right? And with Republicans in control of the Senate, I sort of thought, well, done deal. That's the replacement. That's what it's going to be. I mean, he's even a former Kennedy clerk. And then all of a sudden, almost like we've seen this somewhere before, after the committee hearings happen, we get this rather explosive allegation that he attempted to rape a woman in high school at like a party. And at first in the form of this anonymous letter and then in the form of she herself saying that this is what happened and being willing to appear to testify before the committee. And the thing that I kept thinking about while this was happening was, you know, usually when there's one person, there's not just one.
Right.
You know, like very rarely do people do this kind of thing and then just never do it again. Lo and behold, it turns out that there's another woman now from college, a woman named Deborah Ramirez, who says that a sort of different but equally, you know, bad thing happened with them in college. And then now you start to wonder, you know, how many people are really out there? And, you know, he denies all of this, but it's like, it's really uncanny because it's like watching the Anita Hill thing, except like I'm an adult now.
Okay, I have a question for you. One of his defenses, Kavanaugh's defenses, has been that he was a virgin during high school. So he definitely didn't sexually assault anyone.
I've never sexually assaulted anyone. I did not have sexual intercourse or anything close to sexual intercourse in high school or for many years thereafter.
So friends. You're saying that all through all these years that are in question, you were a virgin?
That's correct.
Never had sexual intercourse with anyone in high school?
Correct.
And through what years in college, since we're probing into your personal
many
life
years,
here?
Many years after. I'll leave it at that. Many years after.
So I feel like that's weird, but I'm not a legal scholar. So you, as a law professor, can you tell us, is there some Latin word that like describes these defenses? Like Virginia innocente?
Exculpatoris. Yeah. Virginia exculpatoris.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
That's not a thing because, number one... both of the assaults that are described don't involve having sex. And
right.
So you could actually do them as a virgin.
In right. fact, that's what's I so great like, about them.
Yeah, we know about incels now. And so, like, you know, I don't know. Maybe Brett Kavanaugh was a high school incel. I have no idea. But, this is an attempted rape. And then, like, the pushing of his, like, penis in the face of this, you know, poor woman who he was at Yale with, neither of those involve having sex. They have nothing to do with anything. So
right.
I would actually sort of believe it more from a frustrated virgin. But quite frankly, it has nothing to do with anything.
Right. And
yeah.
Another one has been that he did not put down the 1982 party in question in his calendar, which he's
yeah.
kept because
yeah.
he's a normal person.
That's not psycho at all.
Yeah, exactly.
We're just getting some new reporting from the New York Times that Kavanaugh plans to submit a calendar from 1982 that he kept with no such party marked on it.
You know, as to the calendar thing, man, I got to say, like somebody being able to produce a detailed record of what they were up to in high school, like this many years later, I think that's actually independently disqualifying because you are not a human. You are
right.
an alien if you have
right.
that stuff.
Yeah.
Who keeps that kind of stuff? I couldn't tell you what I was doing in that level of detail like 2 months ago.
Same.
That's crazy.
And that was in 1982, ladies and gentlemen. That's what he kept his, like, that just is a weird thing, like a psycho thing, like Norman Bates style thing. Like, who keeps a 1982
yeah.
calendar?
Well, even assuming it's like totally up to date and you like write down like, okay, like time to go to secret party and
right.
drink beer because, you know, Mike's friends or Mike's parents are out of town or whatever,
right.
which like, you know, look, I don't know how dedicated to record keeping you are, but I don't
right.
write that kind of thing down, but whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I'm waiting for him to like his legal team to submit a vision board, which like
yeah.
doesn't manifest
yeah.
attempted date
yeah.
rape.
Exactly.
As exonerating
so you've seen, here are my affirmations.
Yeah, exactly.
And none of it involved putting my genitals in someone's face. And
right.
so you see, I
right.
did not do it.
Yeah. It's also kind of a pathetic thing to say. I mean, I guess the guy isn't running on for being spontaneous, but like one can go to a party without planning it. Unless I guess.
Yeah, I've heard
does
that.
Does he like put that, plug it back, like write it back in? After
yeah,
the
I don't know. Do you go back and update the calendar with all the stuff you in fact did that day? Because that would be like, that would be weird, but I guess it's no weirder than keeping it, the calendars
right.
for this many years.
Right.
Right. And it's just, it's all part of it. It's a very strange sort of form of denial where he's like, you know, I have no idea what party you're talking about, but I have proof I didn't go to it.
Right.
And then this is usually where the defenders take over and he says, I didn't do anything like that, but then the defenders take over and they say, and even if he did, well, you know, boys will be boys.
Right.
And so, I don't know, like, pick a lane, folks.
Right, right, exactly, yeah. Let's pick a narrative. That's,
yeah.
yeah. That's another thing. We're seeing, like, a beautiful dovetailing of denial via virginity and calendar notes. And
yeah.
also, it's no NBD, hashtag NBD, no big deal if you try to assault someone.
Yeah.
Because that's what
right.
guys do in high school.
Because that's what guys do in high school, which is like, it's of course, those are obviously like contradictory at a really important level, but they're also sort of horrifying. Because right. I actually think that a lot of the men who are saying that do believe it. They're like, oh, I thought everybody did this when they were a teenager. And it's just like, no, it's just you psychos who have this like totally warped view of the world. You grow up to be the people you kind of are right now.
Right.
I believe you do that kind of thing in high school. But that's kind of the problem.
Yeah. Oh, another, I don't want to leave out this other excuse, which is that he is like, as he liked to point out, as he pointed out the other day, he's a, was like busy going to church. He's like really, he's a good Catholic. And it's like, how much longer is being part of, no disrespect, Ian, we'll get into this in a second. This is a Catholic friendly show, but like how much longer is the Catholic Church allowed, going to be allowed to be used as an excuse for like not sexually assaulting someone? Like, I kind of feel like your association with the Catholic Church is not the best, not yours, Ian's. I mean, one's association with the Catholic Church is not the most exonerating thing.
Well, it's clearly not inherently exculpatory because, look, I'll just say as the designated token Catholic on this show, Mass is usually held more like at like 10 a.m. in the morning and wouldn't preclude you going to a party at night. So, you know, I was at church isn't really like an alibi. So that's not really how any of this works at all. So I don't really, I mean, look, that's the entire kind of premise of the religion is that we routinely do terrible sins and need forgiveness for them.
Right.
That's actually kind of baked right in.
Right.
So that's not actually an exculpatory anything, right? That's a reason that it would be, he himself would regard it as bad if it happened. Right. That would make sense as it's sort of like, you know, kind of against the rules, but otherwise doesn't make a ton of sense.
Right. And you do have a mechanism built in, I believe, the confessional.
Yes. And it involves admitting what you did, not just so that's the thing that's blown my mind so much with all these people saying, well, you know, shouldn't this thing that happened a long time ago, is this really going to ruin this guy's life? And I'm like, look, I believe in forgiveness and I believe in restorative justice. And,
same.
You know, I believe in all of those things for people who commit, you know, murder and assaults and all sorts of horrible things. But you do have to start by admitting that you did it. Right. And so if he didn't, and he's saying he didn't, then that's one thing. Right. But that is totally incompatible with, well, I did it, but I would like forgiveness. Well, you know, again, you got to pick a lane here. And he's picked the lane. And so I feel like his defenders have to stay in that lane.
Right.
And will it really ruin his life? Or is this just more that disqualifies him from continuing to ascend in the ladder and become a Supreme Court justice?
Well, yeah, that's the thing, right, is because the worst thing that's going to happen to him is that he will not become one of the 9 most powerful lawyers on the planet Earth. Instead, he will remain among the, I would say, maybe 30 most powerful lawyers on the planet Earth. And what I think that they mean when they say, oh, it's going to ruin his life, is it's going to spoil his destiny, right? That's what they mean, that he is born to do this. And we cannot let this sort of knock him off the track, because this is how this story is supposed to end. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right at all. There are plenty of people out there who, you know, probably thought the exact same thing about themselves in high school, and they ended up just being, you know, quote, just being really rich law firm partners in Washington, D.C., you know, vacationing on the, you know, wherever you vacation when you live in D.C. and you're real rich. So that's what I think they mean by ruin, is spoil the story.
It's almost Calvinian with the predestination.
Calvinist. Exactly.
There you go.
Predestined. And it almost does feel that way. But like all great stories about destiny, you know, you got to have kind of Chekhov's gun hanging on the wall in Act One when he's at this elite high school. Anyway, it's kind of like, it's almost sort of like in a way that picking somebody from like this elite prep school who then became like an Ivy League frat boy was not like the heads up choice at this particular moment in human history and political affairs. I don't know. It's like, in retrospect, it's almost like you could have seen this coming.
He's a creature of the swamp, and you'd think that everybody who aligned themselves with Trump or thought of this as an outsider's election year.
That's actually interesting, because this is fascinating. I never thought about this before, but who would be the most like on brand, non-swampy judge? Because like the Supreme Court is inherently somewhat an old boys network, right? So what is the most non-insiderish person that Trump could have even nominated? Are there like, what's a non-swampy Supreme Court pick look like from Donald Trump? Like, if you could cast him or her.
You've got so Mike Lee's, I think his brother is on the like Utah Supreme Court.
That's what
and then
I
you've
like.
Got Mike Lee himself. Right. So people would be sort of kind of outside of the sort of mainstream D.C. conservative legal establishment. But, it gets a little thin, actually, unless you want to really like go totally outside the box and have like, you know, Chief Justice Omarosa or something.
Right.
But the problem is the gravitational pull of the sort of Federalist Society among, you know, respectable Republican lawyers. It's like this is, you know, there is no alternative. You know, there's no like alt Fed sock. It doesn't exist.
Right.
And so, you know, you'd really be looking at that point to like a truly outside the box pick, like a some prominent businessman or something who is like maybe not even a lawyer. Or
right,
like,
I guess
there's no requirement that they be lawyers, right?
Oh,
so you
really?
Could pick a of course not. I mean, they all have been, but
so Jeff Bezos could become a Supreme Court justice.
There you go. Right. Now there you go. That's management thinking.
Now who would Trump pick? Like, who do you think Trump, if he could have his druthers, who do you think he would pick? Like, anyone can answer this question, by the way, because since you don't have to be a lawyer to be a Supreme Court judge, no disrespect, Ian, I'm going to say you don't have to be a law professor to answer this question. So you and Gabe can each have at it.
I'll let Gabe go first, because I want to think about this one a little bit.
I know. You guys want to swap.
Look, I'd make my daughter the Supreme Court justice.
Ivanka.
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. That's a good choice.
Yeah. Oh.
She's beautiful. She's easy on the eyes.
Yeah.
You know, I'd date her.
Yeah.
Guys.
I think that's a good one. And I'll suggest a complimentary one, which is Ivanka's husband. Most people don't know, but she's actually married to this guy named Jared.
Yeah.
He actually is a lawyer, not one who is very distinguished, but who was a year ahead of me in law school.
Oh.
So he actually even is a lawyer. And then he would have to go away, which probably I get the sense Trump would like. So there you go. He could be Jared. He could be Justice Jared.
Oh, you mean his like romantic competition? The son-in-law that
exactly.
is his romantic competition?
Yeah, exactly. Get that guy. Get him off reading the briefs and then it's clear sailing.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Wow. Well, Donald, we gave you two really great options.
And you just keep it in the family.
Keep it in the family. Yeah, the family. Wow.
Exactly.
I didn't even know you didn't have to be a Supreme Court judge. I mean, a lawyer to be a...
Yeah, no, you don't have to be. The only thing you have to be a lawyer for, I think, in the United States is to be the Solicitor General of the United States. You have to be a person learned in the law.
Mm.
But, like, traditionally, I think it's been true that all of the Supreme Court justices have been lawyers, but they haven't all been, like, practicing lawyers, right? Like, Earl Warren was principally the governor of California before Eisenhower nominated him to sort of eliminate a political rival in the Republican Party. So he was, like, a lawyer, but, like, not really.
Right.
You know, I mean, he had a law degree, but like, you know, so what? Like Ted Cruz has a law degree. You don't think of him as like this big lawyer.
I mean, but as we all know, traditionally, yeah. But what is Donald Trump if not an anti-traditionalist?
I know. He's not really thinking outside the box, man. He's nominating all these, you know, kind of FedSoc normal guys.
Yeah. That's kind of disappointing, actually.
Yeah. I was really hoping he would think big, but he's thinking totally normal. He's having a normal one.
He's like, he's appointing a swamp creature, and he's supposed to be draining the swamp.
A little bog beast that yeah. came from Georgetown Prep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think? Can you talk a little bit about how this compares to the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings? I know you were a kid at the time, as was I, but I was an avid supporter of Anita Hill.
Well, there's obviously some pretty clear similarities, but I think what's most interesting are the differences, right, which cut in different directions than you might think. So number one, people forget this, but the Democrats were like way in control of the Senate when Justice Thomas was nominated. They had approaching 60 seats in the Senate. They had a really firm majority. And in fact, it is the last time that the Senate has confirmed a justice from the opposite party of the Senate. Since then, that is the last time that's happened. Every time since then that a Supreme Court justice has been confirmed, the president and the Senate have been in the same party, which is pretty wild that, first of all, it's been that long. And second, the last time it would happen was like one of the most controversial Supreme Court nominations of all time. But like part of the reason that happened was, you know, you had had Thurgood Marshall, who was the first black Supreme Court justice, resigned because he was really not in very good health at all. And there was an overwhelming pressure to not let the court go back to being an all-white institution, a very good pressure. But given that George H.W. Bush was president, the ranks of like elite, well-qualified black Republican lawyers, like that's not a long list at the time. And, you know, it's not a super long list now, but it was really short then. And so you had Judge Thomas on the D.C. Circuit for a very short period of time. And the Democratic Party was kind of at these odd cross pressures where, you know, simultaneously, if you reject this, you know, this nominee, there's really no guarantee that that's not going to end up with like, okay, well, here's some, you know, white guy from like Georgetown Prep and Yale. And at the same time, you have, you know, you're cross pressured because these allegations of really serious sexual harassment are really bad. But it's also, you know, I think that all of the members of the Judiciary Committee then were men, or at least the overwhelming majority of them. And this is the early 90s. So people are not exactly like woke, like, you know, Me Too is like, you know, 20 plus years in the future. So it's the same a little bit in the timing is uncanny, right? That like, again, you have the hearings conclude and these really serious allegations emerge. I think the allegations here, I mean, that with Anita Hill, they were very serious. These are even, you know, even more serious. They involve actual physical violence. So they're at least as bad and, you know, maybe even worse. It's crazy that they emerge in the same way after the normal hearings are sort of concluded and you have to convene everybody and call it all back. But the differences to me are what's interesting, because now the Republicans are in control. It's Chuck Grassley instead of Joe Biden. And actually Chuck Grassley and Joe Biden aren't actually acting that different from one another, which is itself rather troubling. So it's this weird rhyming feature of history. You know what I mean? Like, it's like that, but it's not quite like that.
Right. And you mentioned Joe Biden, which is something I think a lot of people don't really know about. Can you talk a bit, as someone who one of the things we really appreciate about you is how fair and balanced you are. Don't pull your punches when it comes to Dems either. Can you talk a little bit about Joe Biden's role in the Thomas confirmation hearings?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it was Charles Ogletree who was Anita Hill's counsel, and Ogletree is a professor at Harvard. I think it was him who was her counsel at the time. And he's basically still mad at Biden. And I think that Anita Hill's was also a law professor, I would imagine. She's also pretty mad at him still, because Joe Biden, for example, declined to call any witnesses other than Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, even though there were witnesses that she said would corroborate her account of what had happened when she was working at the EEOC with Judge Thomas, right? So there are these people who she said, look, they'll corroborate my account. They'll say and that he did all the stuff that I'm saying that he did. And Biden didn't call any of them. Basically, it's a little hard to get an explanation from him sometimes about why exactly he did that.
off the rails in general about a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's a little hard to pin it down. But, you know, basically,
Sloppy Joe just came up with.
Yeah, exactly.
That.
It's really hard to defend. And, you know, his questioning of, you know, Anita Hill in particular is, you know, it's very strange if you sort of sit down and read it. Like, I think it was Ogletree who said, you know, he was almost as bad as the Republicans.
Can you tell the committee what was the most embarrassing of all the incidences that you have alleged?
But it's tonally very strange and sort of hostile.
It is appropriate to ask Professor Hill anything any member wishes to ask her to plumb the depths of her credibility.
And then when he introduces, you know, Clarence Thomas has these sort of famous remarks during that hearing where he says,
as a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you. You will be lynched, destroyed, caricatured by a committee of the U.S. Senate rather than hung from a tree.
Biden says, okay, you know, we'll now hear from sort of, you know, Judge Thomas. And he sort of remarks to him, he's like, you know,
Judge, it's a tough day and tough night for you, I know.
You know, I know this has been a tough night for you, in this really like empathetic way. And when you hear that now, you're like, Yeah, I guess it would be a pretty hard night for a very good reason. Like, you know, maybe your empathy is a bit misplaced here, Joe. I don't know. He, as far as I am aware, he has said things like, I owe her an apology or things like that, but I don't think he's ever actually apologized. To me, that's a bit of a serious problem because this is one of the most infamous failures in the confirmation process in, like, American history, and we kind of all just act like the whole thing never happened.
It's very, very weird, yeah.
So this would come back to bite him if Joe Biden ran for president
in
2020.
That's the thing. That's why I don't take these Biden 2020 things very seriously, because it's like, yeah, I'm sure Joe Biden is really going to run for president in the Democratic primaries in like the Me Too era. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's going to go great. Right. Like, because it's not like he didn't already have two chances at this. And he wasn't like, those were like really close calls. Right. He's run for president twice before. And he like came in like 19th place in Iowa both times and dropped out. So, you know, I don't feel like that's really going to be a real thing. So, you know, thanks, but no thanks.
Right. I was just looking up the transcripts. He's like really passive aggressive. He comes off kind of like as a dick.
Yes, exactly.
Committee will please come to order.
Yeah, there's this weird section at the beginning where he's like apparently Anita Hill's like family is kind of like trying to get into the hearing room where they're like waiting outside.
Right.
He's like, well, we could sit them down, but like all these people are sitting behind you. Like, do they really need to be sitting there? And I'm like, Joe, this is actually a kind of a serious thing. Like, could you, it's just so disorientingly strange the way he behaves in this hearing. And there's no sense of like, there's no sense of gravity. And there's also no sense that he remotely believes her, right? Like he's asking all these questions like, well, did you guys sort of like, you know, was this all these weird comments were they like related to what you were working on?
Right.
It's like, no, I really don't know what you think goes on at the EEOC. It's actually kind of the opposite of this,
right.
Ideally is the idea. So, it's not good. And it's just a complete, you know, failure. I mean, and I think it really does demonstrate, look, at least everything is horrible most of the time, but some things have actually gotten a little better.
Right.
And the way that the Democratic Party is treating, the sort of, you know, Dr. Blasey Ford and the other people who have come forward with these really serious allegations is like markedly superior, although it's still not as good as it could be, to where they were in the early part of the 1990s when they were like getting ready to like elect Bill Clinton. So,
right.
You know, I guess some things do slowly get better sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. He said, can we start already? Lord, let's not wait. Let's have every able-bodied person just grab a chair and bring it out. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Nice little, you know, anybody who's, you know, if you're not able-bodied.
Yeah,
know,
I know.
The hell with you. That's nice.
I know. It's so he like also the ableism. So he's like double.
Yeah,
it's a double no-no. Yeah. Yeah. That's
yeah.
So
tagging that in there.
Yeah. It's so weird because like his lane, he really tries to play the like woke male ally. But I guess he's also really into punctuality and bad mood.
This is important stuff. That's the thing that blows my mind the most is like he won't call these other witnesses, and you know the sort of Republicans in the Judiciary Committee are saying something similar now. Like, well, we have to have the vote. We have to have the vote really fast. It has to be now. Like, these people are going to serve on the Supreme Court presumptively for the rest of their natural lives, decades, right?
Right.
2 or 3 weeks, one way or the other, in any sane process, ought to be just meaningless, right? Because who cares? Right. Oh, he's going to miss the sort of October arguments, you know, whatever. Like, they can re-argue them later in the year, or they'll just do it with an 8-member court. Like, you got to be kidding me with this. It's transparently connected to the sort of midterm elections, which is just about the worst reason in the world to kind of like hustle this stuff through.
Right. It's pretty overt. Like, it's pretty it's overtly
overt.
Partisan. Yeah.
You've argued places, including Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News. You said that basically if you're an innocent person, which is what Brett Kavanaugh is claiming to be, he should be thrilled, chomping at the bit to be investigated by the FBI. I'm summarizing and hyperbolizing a little, but not really.
Not really.
Professor, I'm glad you're here as a law professor. I want to ask you about what Senator Gillibrand said today. She's a lawyer as well, I believe. And she said that the new standard is unless you call for an FBI investigation into yourself, you are by definition guilty. Is that a legal standard that you recognize?
Well, what I like to think about is if I were, as Brett Kavanaugh says, an innocent man, and if I were falsely accused of something this serious, what would I want? And as I teach civil procedure and I think about criminal procedure, and as I think through that question, what I would want is a process that was regarded as so fair, even by my ideological adversaries, that I would live the rest of my life being able to point to the process and say, we had this out, and everyone can agree the way we did it was fair, and I was cleared. That's what I would want.
I would want that, too, and I think we would both agree that the first thing you would want in that process is a full explanation of what the charges are from the person who's making them. And he hasn't received that. None of us have. But barring that, and I'm not attacking her, though I think all of us should be distressed that she's not explaining herself, but that's not what Gillibrand said. She said, if you don't ask for an FBI investigation into yourself, that is an indication that you are guilty. And let me just suggest the obvious, which is that is insane. That is a third world standard. That is an un-American standard. And it's hard for me to believe that an elected U.S. senator would say something like that in public. She shouldn't say that innocent people have a moral obligation to call down upon themselves an FBI investigation. That's insane. Why doesn't anyone
I quite agree with that.
Yes.
But if I were an innocent man, I wouldn't think of it as my obligation, but rather my privilege. Well, I would insist. If I were Brett Kavanaugh and if I were an innocent man, I would insist on pointing every camera on God's green earth in my face as I denied these allegations if I were an innocent man,
truthfully.
I want everyone to see it, wouldn't you?
I believe he's already done that. I think he's been the subject of six FBI investigations into his background checks by federal agents. And I believe he's testifying Monday, and he'll likely repeat what he's already said, which is, I don't know what she's talking about. I didn't do this. She, by contrast, who is the reason we're having this conversation in the first place, leveled a charge of felonious behavior against a public official and then has refused to explain herself. So where's the onus on her? She's dragged the whole country into this and short-circuited a process the rest of us are vested in and not bothered to explain herself? I know you're not supposed to, like, attack the victim, but at some point, she's not in charge of this country. So why can't we ask her for the full story?
Well, I do think that as we say often in the law, the government is entitled to every person's evidence. And I do think it would be very useful if she would testify. But again, just to keep with the frame a little bit, if I were Brett Kavanaugh, and if I were an innocent man, I would say, look, you don't want to testify on Monday. Take a week. Take 2 weeks. Take a month. Because when this is done, and if I am confirmed, I will not live my life under a cloud where people can say, well, the reason you got through is because we rushed it. Take a month. This is my life.
But then if you were facing opponents who publicly declared that you were guilty on the basis of no evidence and used as evidence the fact that you didn't request an FBI investigation into yourself, you would acknowledge you're dealing with unreasonable people who don't care about justice, who are merely trying to destroy your life for political ends. So maybe you'd behave differently. Or am I being crazy here?
Well, I don't know about that. If I were facing unreasonable people and if I were an innocent man, what I would say is, fine, you want to delay the hearing a month? Delay it. You want the FBI to look into it? Look into it. You want to interview
some
this witness in closed session?
Some more people can accuse me anonymously.
I'm an innocent man.
Yeah, I wish we lived in a country. I'd be happy to participate in such a system. But when you have people saying what Kirsten Gillibrand said today or Congressman Garamendi said today, you're dealing with unreasonable people who don't care about justice. And it's scary. And I know that you believe that.
Prosecutors often don't, and that is why it would be important,
I agree, in his position,
to position yourself as a person who says, these people are unreasonable, and the way I will prove it to you is I will give them everything they want, and they will find
Doing that Monday.
I'm an innocent man, I were an innocent man.
I think that's the claim. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so, like, I think that's right. Like, look, obviously, as a general matter, if you're facing a criminal investigation, I think that you should sort of stand on your rights and, you know, just insist that, you know, you're not going to cooperate with the government. That's like the classic legal advice, and that's true. But this is a really special situation where if you're confirmed under this cloud of suspicion and you're confirmed under circumstances that your political opponents don't regard as legitimate, that's actually a problem for you for the rest of your life because they're going to keep believing that you did it. So if you're actually, like, imagine you're Brett Kavanaugh and you're like, look, I imagine I'm Brett Kavanaugh and I'm just like, oh, this is crazy. I'm drunk now. It's fun. Imagine
exactly.
That. And like, you're totally innocent. And you're like, man, this is like, this is mistaken identity. The doppelganger did the first thing. And then the second thing, it was like somebody else. And then this other thing was like also different. Imagine that all that is improbably true. I would actually really want to make sure that all the people who were inclined to believe that actually could see a process where that innocence was demonstrated, like, to their satisfaction. Because if it's not, right, like, imagine it's not. And Brett Kavanaugh's confirmed, but, like, you know, 45 to 48% of the country thinks that he did all this stuff. It's like, they're not just going to sit there and do nothing about it, right? Like, I'm running around trying to figure out some way to convince these sort of centrist liberals that, like, you need to have more justices on the Supreme Court, that you need to pack the courts.
Right.
And I can't imagine a better way than for them to be like, well, you know, we had the Merrick Garland thing, which resulted in Gorsuch, and then Brett Kavanaugh was credibly accused of all these sex crimes, but nobody cared about it, and we had this process that was totally bogus. So, man, Ian, I guess you're right. I guess we should probably add some justices, like 4 to 6, right? Like, and if you're Brett Kavanaugh, that's horrible for you, right? That you right. are the instrument of the destruction of the 9-member court. Whereas if you're like, look, I'm going to show up to this sort of Senate confirmation room like every day at 8 a.m. and I'll answer questions until there's no more senators there. And if the FBI wants to, like, you know, come to my house and, you know, interview me or whatever, like, whatever you want to do, what you're not going to find is anything. You're not going to find any proof that I did any of this stuff because I know I'm an innocent man. And I understand that you wouldn't do that in a normal criminal investigation, but this is not normal, right? This is a very different circumstance. And if I were innocent, I would want to clear my name, wouldn't you? I mean, these are incredibly, incredibly serious allegations, and I want people thinking that about right. me, right? That I did this horrible stuff. I would want the chance to prove that I didn't.
Speaking of the packing the court, you wrote a piece this month, actually in September. Is Brett Kavanaugh the problem, or the U.S. Supreme Court itself? Are you basically a Kavanaugh apologist?
I'm not a Kavanaugh apologist. I mean, I think Kavanaugh is. In terms of judges that might be plausibly selected by Republican presidents on the sort of jurisprudential merits, he's like, you know, normal, not really extreme in one direction or another. But the sort of argument of the piece is that we have decided, for reasons that are a little hard to explain, that a lot of the most important controversies in American political life are going to be settled by this, like, quasi-aristocratic, life-tenured group of lawyers who have no obvious expertise on these matters and who we have no political or democratic control over. And, you know, once you decide to do that and have that basically aristocratic method of decision-making, you know, no kidding, it's going to advantage the aristocrats. Mm. And so I think that the left or certain parts of the left tends to be attached to this vision of the court as a sort of champion of minority rights, right? They think about, like, Brown v. Board and, like, desegregation of schools, and they think about the abortion decisions like Roe and Casey. And they think about, well, you know, what about same-sex marriage, Obergefell right. and Windsor and cases like that. And that's, you know, that's fine so far as it goes. And I'm not going to say that the Supreme Court has never done anything good. But what's striking is that with all of those things, right, you know, sort of racial justice, abortion rights, you know, rights for same-sex couples, all of those things are things that can be achieved with political organizing. And, like, building real political muscle, like, on the ground by organizing, you know, working people to do these things. And in fact, there's pretty good evidence that the court was only willing to do that stuff once the requisite political muscle was organized on the ground, because it's not like the court can really force anyone to do anything. Mm. Whereas all the damage that they're going to do, right? So, like, in the Janus decision, when they decide to, like, you know, try to basically assassinate public sector labor unions by denying them agency fees, you know, good luck organizing to change that result, because now it's like a rule of constitutional law and right. you have to amend the Constitution to do anything about it. And so it's really unclear to me why the left, who I would have thought believed in, like, the popular organization of the working class, is, like, so excited to assign the resolution of important controversies to 9 people, like, 6 of whom went to Harvard Law School and 3
right.
went to Yale Law School. Like, why is this? Why do you want to do this? It's
right.
really unclear to me.
That's interesting. I just remembered in college, I had this great history professor named Richard Vann, who I think was a kind of like, he was left, but I remember him saying, like, well, what's so great about, he was being provocative, and I don't even know if he believed this or was just challenging us, but he was like, you know, what's so great about democracy? Like, sometimes it's better to have 9 people in charge. You think, like, and this was I graduated in 03, so this was in 2000. So he was like, you think, like, with gay marriage or same-sex marriage, the people would want to protect would want that before the Supreme Court?
Yeah. Well, here
or protecting minority rights, you know, as And, yeah, and I remember thinking, like, say, yeah, you're right. Democracy is kind of dangerous. We need a philosopher king or queen.
Yeah.
I volunteer myself, but yeah.
Yeah, this is what people always say, which is like, well, if you assign, if the people get to decide whether or not, like, for example, there's going to be like, you know, like abortion rights,
right,
then there's going to be like, you would have all these southern states where abortion was basically inaccessible to everybody except rich people who could afford to travel. And I'm like, are you hearing what you're saying? Do you not understand you are describing the world we live in right now?
Right.
Because over time, these nine lawyers who are very smart and some of them are great writers, it's not like they have some army that can enforce these results, right? And it's not like they have some ability to like buck popular will forever, and they can't. And so what you really see is that they are downstream from like real political muscle. The reason that they can mandate nationwide same-sex marriage in Obergefell is because by that point, most people already wanted that, right? Like, if you had taken a nationwide referendum the day Obergefell was decided and said, is the United States going to have marriage equality or not, you know, marriage equality would have won. So it's like the Supreme Court wasn't really doing all that much in these cases. And whereas they are very effective instruments of, like, capital, like, they're very effective instruments of reinforcing the sort of existing political power structures that, like, are the thing you would want to popularly organize against in the first place, right? The Janus decision is a great example of that. Citizens United is a great example of that. And so, you know, this whole story that, like, well, we need these wise aristocrats because that's the only way that, you know, you can't possibly – after all, if you were a sort of, you know, 8-year-old black kid living in the South hoping for, like, you know, good desegregated schools and voting rights, how could you possibly complain about the results from the Supreme Court that you've gotten over the years, right? Like, no, that's crazy. They're not – these people are not going to save you. You still have to do real politics. Right. Like, it's this faith in this anti-democratic magic that is going to rescue you from something, and it's not going to rescue you from anything.
Huh. So are there any examples which wouldn't undermine your – argument anyway, but I'm just curious, are there examples where the Supreme Court has been ahead of the curve?
There are examples where they've been ahead of the curve. I think probably the most significant one is actually Roe v. Wade, where there was a growing desire in the United States for more liberalized abortion laws. And the Texas law at issue in Roe was quite extreme. It was one of the most extreme in the country. And so one of the things that actually Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has argued is that the court in Roe, by announcing this sort of nationwide, you know, quite inflexible rule that was back then a trimester system, like you can do this in the first trimester, this in the second, this in the third, got way out ahead of public opinion and could have just said, this extreme Texas law goes too far, but we're not going to necessarily decide that there's going to be some sort of, you know, constitutional code of abortion for the entire country. And she's argued that they went a little too fast on that. But the thing is, yeah, they got out ahead of public opinion. And we have spent like the last 40 to 50 years paying the price for it because they were so far ahead of public opinion that it galvanized like a generation of anti-abortion activists who coalesced around the Supreme Court as their like central issue. And like they are the reason that Trump got elected president because they were like, look, we don't like a lot of this stuff, but we understand that we are like these committed activists on abortion. And he is going to appoint, you know, the Federalist Society judges that we have been informed that we want. And so that's the way to win. So like, you know, there is a price to be paid for these things and these compromises, you know, getting out of ahead of the curve is not like stable, right? Because eventually the people are going to have what they want, right? Mm-hmm. There's no way that nine old lawyers are going to stop them from having what they want forever. There's no way.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
So you think that like, so what would you do? Cause this is another question. Like you are a law professor, but you're also a socialist.
Yeah.
And are, you know, believe in organizing. So like, what do you think people should be doing at different levels? What do you think organizers should be doing? What do you think lawyers or should be doing? Like, how should people be mobilizing around this nomination?
Yes. So around the nomination, I think I'm actually pretty impressed that So to take that in several stages, you know, number one, I was very impressed that there was a lot of popular organizing around opposition to like the Kavanaugh nomination, even though everyone said, oh, it's a done deal.
Right.
And it did feel like it was a done deal, but there was enough popular organizing that Democratic senators on the Judiciary Committee and also in the broader Senate weren't able to just sort of get on board and be like, oh, he's this well-qualified man, which created the space for something to happen, right? Like those organizers understood perfectly well that they're not going to organize the Republicans into voting no.
Right.
But they can at least maybe create a space where, like, who knows, something could happen in the committee, something, a document could come out, or, you know, lo and behold, some allegation from when he was younger. If they hadn't done that, then we're probably not in the situation that we're in. But I think in terms of a sort of long-term strategy for the left, you know, usually when I talk to other you know, especially young socialists, like the courts are not a big part of their strategy for change. And I think that's quite appropriate. That the best thing that, you know, the minimum what you'd hope from the courts is that they would get out of the way, right? Like there's not a big role for the courts in like abolishing ICE or creating Medicare for all or doing, you know, universal public, you know, college or things like that. Like the courts are just not positioned to do something like that. Everything that the sort of organized socialist left wants is stuff you have to do with legislation. And that's good. That's great. So all we want is the courts to sort of stay out of the way. But you can have the courts in a sort of intermediate position of like, you know, reinforcing, for example, sort of like left-leaning power structures, or at least not attacking it, right? Like that's the whole project of the sort of anti-union cases in the court right now, is that like, especially Justice Alito understands really well that, you know, organized labor is an important source of political power on the left. And so if you can break it using Supreme Court decisions that'll be enforced, then, you know, that doesn't, you know, double ICE or anything, but it eliminates a sort of like major oppositional force that will, you know, then clear the way to achieve whatever the substantive goals are. And so I think some contrary project like that could be really valuable. But at the moment, and, you know, until the courts are enlarged, the left is going to be playing defense. And so I think any strategy for the political left that relates to the courts is like, well, you got to start by adding justices, because otherwise I don't understand what the idea is here at all.
Right. So packing the courts. Okay. You reminded me of how one of the big refrains about like the significance between the difference between Democrats and Republicans. You hear this a lot. Like, look at the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's often used as a kind of, not overtly, but it maybe functions as a brake. Like it puts the brakes on certain things. Because, I mean, this is a huge question that requires a lot of unpacking, but whatever, that's what you do for a living, so I can ask you this. How kind of like kosher a question or framing is that? Like that, because of Supreme Court nominations, that really, I mean, this gets into organizing and electoral politics too, but like, how much of a good like motto is that for supporting Democratic nominees? I guess.
Well,
it's kind of a hard question. It's like a lot.
It is a hard question, but I do think it exposes like a basic asymmetry, right? Mm-hmm. Like what I think the right wants to do with the courts is they want to use the courts to sort of shut down the left's political program, which will mostly exist in the form of legislation, right? And it's a very natural sort of thing to do, because it's like, oh, no, look, we have this elite institution filled up with, you know, elite educated lawyers and things like that. What the Democratic Party has basically been doing with regard to the Supreme Court for a very long time is they're trying to do the same thing. They're trying to say, we're going to shut down the right's political program. But the only thing that they can really point to is the political program on the right of enacting restrictions on abortion and perhaps enacting some restrictions on the rights of like same-sex couples and things like that, right? Because that's their only political program that the left is interested in using the court to sort of guard against, right? And maybe some stuff in terms of, you know, voter ID or partisan gerrymandering, things like that, but that doesn't even seem to be successful at all. And so I think what the left would do a lot better for themselves to say is what, you know, kind of what FDR used to say, which is like the Supreme Court is this meddlesome force in American life. And what we want is popular democracy. We want us to rule ourselves. And so what the right wants to do is they want to use this sort of aristocratic institution to achieve all the aims they can't win at the ballot box. And what we would like them to do is we would like them to get the hell out of the way and let us enact our program. I think that to me is a lot more appealing because it sounds in something that people actually want, which is like self-government. But like the right doesn't have to do that because like their essential base are people who are completely comfortable with sort of like non-democratic forms of government, right? Like nobody who is opposed to labor unions is going to wring their hands if the Supreme Court kills them off. Like they don't care, right? These people, you know, they're capitalists, right? They understand they're outnumbered. Their entire project is to figure out how to win in a world where workers outnumber them 99-1. So they have no problem with that, but it's not symmetrical.
Thank you so much. Where can people find you? Any things you want to plug?
Yeah, so I suppose if you've enjoyed me, check out my Supreme Court podcast, which is called First Mondays. And so it's on the iTunes store and everywhere else you might find your fine podcast. It's just called First Mondays, and it's about the weekly business of the Supreme Court. And so we are about to launch our new season. We have actually just launched the sort of preview of our new season because the court's going to be back in session, talking about Kavanaugh stuff, talking about the cases, all that sort of stuff. And I come off as sort of a measured kind of person on that show. And if you would like some unmeasured stuff, then you can check me out on Twitter, which is just @iSamuel. And that's really that's the real Unmeasured Hours.
Great. And yeah, you are now officially the Katie Halper Show legal correspondent.
Ooh,
you passed the test.
Nice. I'm going to put that on my CV.
Yeah, you should, on your business cards too. Yeah. So that's a lot better than becoming a Supreme Court justice. So
yeah, a hell of a lot better. Well, thanks for having me. It's been really great to be here. A long-term ambition of mine finally fulfilled, and I hope to return very soon.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I'll go to law school so I can go on to yours. That's really the real reason.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could...
Monday fame.
That's just day one of 1L. You're on the show.
Yeah. Awesome.
Good.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ian Samuel.
All right. Thanks for having me, Katie Halper.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
You can hear it at the Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM, WBAI.org.
More about Ian Samuel and what it was like for him to clerk for Antonin Scalia, become Patreon members at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Thanks so much.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.